My name is Isaac Weishaupt, and I'm here to talk to you about Interstellar, the film. I'm going to provide you the symbolism analysis. What was this movie about? It's about everything. And I'm going to tell you the whole truth, nothing but the truth. If you didn't catch that at the beginning there, that's my homage to Sam Tripoli's tinfoil hat. You know what he says. He says he's here to rock. Well, I'm here to rock too, damn it. Here to rock too. We're going to talk about, oh my God, what aren't we going to talk about? It's easier to say what we aren't going to talk about. But basically, if you haven't seen Interstellar with Matthew McConaughey, it's all right. It's all right, all right, all right. But I do need you to know that I will be spoiling the plot. This is one of the greatest films of all time. Top 20 for sure, I'd say. Maybe cracking the top 10, I don't know. If it wasn't damn near 3 hours, it would crack the top 10. We're going to talk about Saturnian symbolism, the idea of perfecting man, the alchemical pursuits of mankind by the occultist to leave this planet and leave this disgusting shell of a body that's limiting us and to create a new civilization out by Saturn. We're going to go through a lot of stuff here, folks, so I want you to strap on and strap in, right?
Late, Coop.
Yeah, we had a flat.
It's an Indian surveillance drone. Solar cells power an entire farm.
What'd you do, Murph?
She didn't do nothing.
Murphy's long.
You're a well-educated man, Coop. And a trained pilot.
And an engineer.
The world doesn't need any more engineers. We didn't run out of planes and television sets. We ran out of food.
Dad, why did you name me after something that's bad?
Oh, we didn't.
Murphy's Law.
Murphy's Law doesn't mean that something bad will happen. It means that whatever can happen will happen.
We must confront the reality that nothing in our solar system can help us.
Now you need to tell me what your plan is to save the world.
We're not meant to save the world. We're meant to leave it. And this is the mission we were trained for.
I've got kids, Professor.
Get out there and save them.
I have no idea when you're coming back.
We must reach far beyond our own lifespans. We must think not as individuals, but as a species. We must confront the reality of interstellar travel.
Murph, I love you forever.
Is it worth it? Is the movie worth it? For 3 hours, it better be. Because here's the part where I tell you my... If you haven't seen Interstellar, should you go watch it before you listen to this? Absolutely. Go watch it and come back if you're maybe a little bit younger and this is all new territory for you. You haven't seen the movie. It was a big hit when it was out. I saw it in the theaters. The answer is a definite yes. This is a great film. Buy it. I paid like, I think it was on sale for like 10 or 15 bucks, worth 20 bucks. It's a premium purchase. Watch it on the biggest, baddest television you can. It's awesome. Great visual effects. Christopher Nolan's a great director. He moved the story along at the right pace. Cause I get bored very easily and 3 hours is way too long for a movie, but this one, he makes it work. Good stuff. If you don't want to watch it or if you don't remember it, I'm going to walk you through it. I'm going to walk you through the whole storyline and break out the occult perspectives as they appear. First, some fun facts. I wrote about this film back in 2014, back in the old golden blogging days on IlluminatiWatcher.com, which is still up. It's still there if you want to look at it. We talked at the time, you remember the S-A-N-D-Y space H-O-O-K shootings that happened? Well, that was a hot topic. And if you recall, Christopher Nolan had a film called Dark Knight Rises. That was the one with Batman and Bane. There was a scene where they point very clearly to that particular term on a map, S-hook. Why am I not saying the words? Because I don't want to get censored, okay? Into oblivion. You know they arrested a guy in January still? They're still arresting truthers for talking about this theory about what happened at the hook. I don't know what happened. I wasn't there. But I don't want to get lumped in with that. I don't need that kind of drama in my life. But anyway, Dark Knight Rises had that scene. And then they also had, and this is stuff I was talking about on the blog, Nathan Crowley, a relative to Aleister Crowley, was a production designer on Batman as well as Interstellar. So he works with Christopher Nolan. Just a curious little fun fact. And then also the voice of the monolithic robots in Interstellar were voiced by Bill Irwin, an actor who was also in a 1998 film called Illuminata. I haven't seen Illuminata, but the artwork, the cover art, shows a staircase going up to the cosmos. It's a story about music, and I don't know, it looks boring to me, so I'm not watching it, but the artwork for the film Interstellar has the spiral on the poster. This is the evolution of consciousness. It's man transcending the limitations of the human body and getting into the higher dimensions, which is exactly what this story is about. Also, Matthew McConaughey was at the same time in a show called True Detective on HBO, which I also did a massive write-up on in the blogging days. And if you recall, season one, there was a dead girl with the horns affixed to her head and a spiral tattooed on her back. She had the spiral tramp stamp on her back. They insert these symbols and messages, charge up the magnetic chain. But let's get into the movie itself. You've been forewarned, plot spoilers, let's go. The year is 2067, and there's a dust bowl killing the crops, choking the people. They actually used footage from Ken Burns' Dust Bowl documentary. Ken Burns was on 60 Minutes recently, by the way. I've seen several of his series, films, whatever you want to call them. They're very good. There's a Vietnam one that was spectacular and tragic and sad at the same time. Anyhow, in the future, they kill off all the crops, all the food. People are choking. They're like, we got to get out of here. We killed the earth. We can't habitate it any longer. And ironically, they have to mask up. They keep masks on them, and they have to mask up whenever a dust storm blows through, which is very fitting to watch in 2020. Now, you know what? I think now is the time to invest in masks, folks, because they're talking already like the pandemic stuff will continue and we'll always have to wear masks and all that stuff. So if you have the capabilities of investing in masks, do it. If that works out for you, slice me off some of that cheddar in the future. So Cooper is played by Matthew McConaughey, and let's not forget to point out the late, great Bill Cooper, William Cooper, the conspiracy theorist who was part of my two-stage red pilling. He and David Icke were the ones that turned me on to this lifestyle. But Cooper, that's Matthew McConaughey. He's like the main character of this movie. I like this movie because there wasn't a ton of characters, so that makes it very easy for me to talk to you guys about it. Well, he is a farmer. He's also an engineer, so we already know what his role will be. As an engineer, it's to kill us all. Well, they show him, he's got the family, he's on the farm, in the farmhouse, and he's talking to his daughter, Murph. about how science works, and they're talking about she's seeing ghosts, and he says, oh, that's not very scientific of you.
Let me guess, is your ghost?
It knocked it off my shelf. Keeps knocking books off.
No such thing as a ghost, dumbass.
Hey.
I looked it up. It's called a poltergeist.
Dad, tell her.
Wow, it's not very scientific, Murph.
You said science is about admitting what we don't know.
She's got you there.
Hey, start looking after our stuff.
Cool.
Murph, you want to talk science? Don't just tell me that you're afraid of some ghost. No, you gotta go further. You gotta record the facts, analyze, get to the how and the why, then present your conclusions. Deal?
Deal.
All right.
You have a good day, school.
Hold up.
Now, this is foreshadowing because the story is about the fusion of science with spirituality, which is what this is all about. This. All of this. Capital T-H-I-S. This. It's the fusion of science with spirituality, the transhuman, evolving mankind into the next thing. Murph, she's got these books getting knocked off her bookshelf by ghosts. Cooper doesn't believe it. He refuses to believe it because he is a scientist through and through. So also as part of this future storyline, they have to repopulate the earth. And the crops are dying. All of them except for corn, how appropriate, right? If you read up on any, like Michael Pollan has a very good book, The Omnivore's Dilemma, where it reveals the politicizing of corn and how we rotate through corn and soy crops and it's destroying the soil and the, you know, I don't know, there's a bunch of farm lobbyists involved. It's a very complicated thing, but more or less, everything revolves around corn. They take corn and make corn syrup, and they use that to replace the sugar. They use the corn to feed the cows, but the cows have three stomachs, and none of them are made to digest the corn, so they get abscesses because of the diet they give them, and then they pump them full of antibiotics because of all the abscesses that they have to live with. But the American diet needs corn-fed cows because it's cheap and subsidized by who? By you. You pay for this system. And you wonder why people have their problems with government. Well, it's not the government that's the problem per se. It's the lobbyist. It's the corporate interest involved. I mean, everyone plays their role in this. But yeah, anyway, corn. Corn is king in 2067, as it is today still. And by the way, Cooper, he's the most unrealistic dad ever. Can we talk about this for a minute? In a 5-minute span at the beginning of this film, they're driving, it's Cooper and his daughter Murph and his son, I think his name is Ted, he's irrelevant in the whole film, he's useless, and they're driving around in this pickup truck, and in a 5-minute span they get a flat tire, the son is driving, he literally almost drives them off a cliff to death, and not one time did Cooper, the father, raise his voice, not once. A flat tire, and then the sun almost kills them. Calm as a Hindu cow. But hey, you know what? That's Matthew McConaughey for you. Next, Cooper, he's talking about, because we got to set up Act 1 here. They're laying the foundations of who this family is and what they do. Cooper wants Murph to go into college, but the schools won't allow her because she got into a fight at school over a conspiracy theory.
Take a seat.
So, we got Tom's scores back. He's gonna make an excellent farmer.
Yeah, he's got a knack for it. What about college?
Well, the university only takes a handful. They don't really have the resources.
I still pay my taxes. Now, where's that money go? There's no more armies.
Well, it doesn't go to the university. Look, Coop, you have to be realistic.
You're ruling my son out for college now? The kid's 15.
Tom's score simply isn't high enough.
What's your waistline? About what, 32? I'm about 33 inseam.
I'm not sure I see what you're getting at.
You're telling me it takes two numbers to measure your own ass, but only one to measure my son's future?
Come on. You're a well-educated man, Coop, and a trained pilot.
And an engineer.
Okay, well, right now, We don't need more engineers. We didn't run out of television screens and planes. We ran out of food. The world needs farmers. Good farmers, like you and Tom.
Uneducated farmers.
We're a caretaker generation, Coop. And things are getting better. Maybe your grandkids will get to be engineers.
We down here, sir?
No. Miss Hanley's here to talk about Murph.
Murph is a great kid. She's really bright, but she's been having a little trouble lately. She brought this in to show the other students the section on the lunar landings.
Yeah, it's one of my old textbooks. She always loved the pictures.
It's an old federal textbook. We've replaced them with the corrected versions.
Corrected?
Explaining how the Apollo missions were faked to bankrupt the Soviet Union.
You don't believe we went to the moon?
I believe it was a brilliant piece of propaganda that the Soviets bankrupted themselves, pouring resources into rockets and other useless machines.
Useless machines?
And if we don't want a repeat of the excess and wastefulness of the 20th century, then we need to teach our kids about this planet, not tales of leaving it.
Yeah, it turns out she had an old book with the fake news about a fake moon landing on the moon. Because in the future, they believe, the consensus belief, which creates reality, is that it was just Cold War propaganda. None of it was real. And Cooper hates this theory because he's a science nerd and he loves NASA. And he loves the idea of moving off planet. But I found that a very curious element for many reasons. One, the conspiracy theory behind it, as I discussed in Kubrick's Code. Because the theory is that Stanley Kubrick filmed a fake moon landing as part of Cold War propaganda. And Interstellar actually has homages to 2001: A Space Odyssey throughout the whole film. So it's curious that the film that Kubrick used to film the fake moon landing is the one with the homages in Interstellar. And we'll refer to 2001: A Space Odyssey many times in this analysis. Well, Murph, she's in her room and these books keep flying off the shelf. She thinks they're ghosts. Cooper thinks she's crazy. And they determine that the books being knocked down correlate to a binary code of zeros and ones with thick and thin lines. And Cooper is like, well, wait a minute. And he provides and he figures out that these are coordinates. And when you hear him talk about the coordinates, he says the number 33. So he punches it on his like GPS or whatever, and they follow it, and it comes up to a gated shack. Imply that it's a military type thing. And the military type folks, he's getting ready to like cut the lock on it. He's like, I'm going in here. I gotta see what's going on in here. Because the ghosts were telling him to go there, right? But what I want to talk about is that the number 33, it could refer to the age of Jesus Christ when he started his ministry, because as you'll find out later, Cooper is the new savior to mankind. He is the Horus character. Also, we can't ignore the 33rd degree of Freemasonry, the Scottish Rite of Freemasonry. The highest level one can get to by invitation only. To do that, to get to 33, you have to accomplish something to support the great work, to find the lost word of Freemasonry. So here we see Cooper is trying to reach 33, but they tell him he's not ready. They stop him. But later, he does, in fact, achieve the great work. But at this point in the film, he's not ready to be initiated. He hasn't achieved the wisdom necessary for the Freemasonic, Luciferian lost word of evolving mankind. Heavy-duty ideas here, but keep that back pocket till later. So he gets in there. And what's curious is that they keep him sort of like, they separate him from his daughter. And in the room that he's in, we're introduced to these monolithic robots, TARS. And it's kind of like the future Marines. There's these monolithic robots. And when I say monolith, I'm speaking of 2001: A Space Odyssey with the Black Monolith, which is what, you know, these monoliths, they play a role. And I always suggest to read the novels for the, because there's four of them in this Odyssey, Space Odyssey sequence. But in the books, the alien consciousness steers these monoliths to do their will, and their will is to evolve life forms on various planets. So, curious enough, this was in fact modeled after the monolith of 2001, these TARS marine robots. So they're talking to Cooper, and, you know, it's a movie, right? You got to suspend disbelief a little bit, but they're just like, okay, you found us, good enough, you're in the club. They let him back in the conference room where they're going to tell him all the secrets because, you know, hey, you know what? You found us, good enough. We'll let you in. And they take him into the meeting room and you see Lazarus on the wall with an all-seeing eye of Horus and the eagle, which is the phoenix, which again represents the alchemical rebirth, the redefining of the new transhuman. And I'll put the photo on the Instagram at Isaac Weishaupt. As always, you know what to do. Like and subscribe. The I think I've juiced you guys for my maximum Instagram audience, so thank you if you've already done so. But yeah, you can see Lazarus on there, which you know, you've got these alchemical references throughout this whole film. They beat you in the face with it. But there's an alchemical meaning here, right? There's the death and rebirth cycle with the phoenix and the Lazarus. Of course, Lazarus raised from the dead by Jesus Christ, whom the occultists believe in, but they say he's not God. They just say he mastered the secret wisdom. He was a magician. They're like, yeah, Jesus was cool, but he wasn't God. That's what they believe. And this is similar to, again, another Christopher Nolan film, The Batman Dark Knight Rises, where Bane was in that pit, because in the comic storyline, there's these things called Lazarus pits, and you got the Ra's al Ghul people, the Gabagool people. They go down these pits to restore their powers and come back to life, essentially. That's why they call them the Lazarus pits. And you saw this character in Bane. Bane was in one, not a Lazarus pit, but he was in a prison pit. He was in darkness until he was in darkness underground until he rose to the surface and came to the light. And the light was blinding. Remember that scene? Again, more occult symbolism. Because in Freemasonry, you got to go from the darkness to the light. And we'll talk about that later. Again, put this in your other back pocket. You're going to run out of pockets soon. The only pocket you're going to have left is your prison pocket. Put this in your other back pocket, because we're going to come back to this, this idea of darkness and lightness. So they let Cooper back there, and they reveal, big reveal, they're like, hey, guess what? We're NASA. Yeah, you thought we were shut down for refusing to bomb people, which I would argue maybe there's some hints of U.S. Space Force there, right? But anyway, they say, look, you thought they disbanded us, but we had some black budget because they're like, look, you got to research and find out why is Mother Earth dying? Why is nitrogen getting too high and oxygen too low? Everyone's going to choke out and die. We got to figure something out. So NASA starts the Lazarus missions to find a new home for all of mankind. Because apparently the future government is like, look, this isn't going to work out for us. Let's get out of here. So we find out that in the briefing room there was, and I'll put again another image. It's just a picture of Saturn, but they talk about, they're briefing Cooper. They're like, look, there was this wormhole out by Saturn that appeared 48 years ago, which I did the math on that. That was 2019 was the year they find it. And they're like, someone placed it there. Someone. They call it they.
Who's they? We started detecting gravitational anomalies almost 50 years ago. Mostly small distortions to our instruments in the upper atmosphere. In fact, I believe you encountered one yourself.
Yeah, over the Straits. I crashed, something tripped my flyby wire.
Exactly. But of all these anomalies, the most significant is this. Out near Saturn, a disturbance of space-time.
At a wormhole?
It appeared 48 years ago.
And it leads where?
Another galaxy.
Now, a wormhole's not a naturally occurring phenomenon.
Someone placed it there.
They?
So yeah, so they, the aliens, or whoever, which we'll find out later who it is. It's like, someone placed this wormhole out by Saturn. We got to go to Saturn for the Enlightenment. Just like, again, 2001 A Space Odyssey. They say, well, you know, these aliens or whoever, they put this black hole here, and when you go, or the wormhole here, and when you go through the wormhole, there's, 12 new worlds within reach. So they sent 12 one-way missions called the Lazarus missions out. And each one was sent to each new world to see if this was a place they could send all of humanity to. So, like, they're like, hey, this is one-way tickets for each of you. Go out there, send a positive response back if all of humanity can come out there to live. So only three missions got positive responses. That was Dr. Mann, Dr. Edmonds, and Dr. Miller. I don't know if all three of them are doctors. Dr. Mann for sure was. He'll come up later. So they call those planets, respectively, Mann, Edmonds, and Miller. Now, let's take a step back here. Look at what this was. This was 12 disciples sent out. And this is, the number 12. There's also the idea there's 13 witches in a coven, right? But you got the 12 disciples. And they have a mission to establish the new world, the new, dare I say, religion. Because this has a lot of Christian undertones, because each disciple was sent out to start the church, the new faith. So that's essentially what you have going on here. So they're telling Cooper, they're like, look, Cooper, we need you, since you found our secret hideaway, now we're going to give you the keys to the space shuttle, and you're going to fly out to the new world and check out these three planets and see which one we should move to. And they say, look, here's our two plans we have. Plan A, you're going to find the right planet and we're going to move all the people from Earth to this new world. But the problem with that is we've got to solve this equation for gravity. We have to master gravity. We don't know how to do it yet. Bob Lazar hasn't figured it out yet. Then plan B is the population bomb. They're like, here's the other plan. We're going to take 5,000 fertilized eggs out to this new planet and repopulate that planet in case we can't master gravity and send all of these mouth breathers on Earth out there to this new planet. Okay? Now, here's a side note. There's a scene where they talk about don't trust the right thing done for the wrong reason.
This world was never enough for you, was it, Coop?
What, because heading out there is what I feel like I was born to do? And it excites me? No, that does not make it wrong.
It might. Don't trust the right thing done for the wrong reason.
Now, if you recall, we talked about this on the Zootopia film analysis. Right? Where they're kind of like talking about this ends justifies the means stuff. I believe Drumpf said something similar when they remember how Drumpf was talking to Bob Woodward, and he was like, look, I already knew that this thing was going to kill way more people than the flu. I didn't want to scare the people. The ends justify the means. Is this similar? Is this the same message? They don't want to tell everyone the truth because everyone can't be trusted. And I don't know if that's right or wrong. I don't know if that's right or wrong entirely. On some levels, it is. That thinking is what gets you on a bad track of not being transparent and sharing information. I always opt for, I'd rather take honesty, but I get how the masses entirely as a whole can't always all be trusted to do the right thing in the face of fear. So I get it. I could be sympathetic to both sides of that argument. So Cooper goes back home and he tells Murph, like, look, I'm about to go out to space here. I'll be back. And she's sad. She said Pops is about to bail on her to find a new planet because Mom's dead. She's been dead. And he's like, look, I'm about to go do this thing. And then they have a sort of sad conversation worth listening to if you're watching the movie. He says, you know, as parents, our job, we're just here as memories for our kids. And once you're a parent, you're the ghost of your child's future, which plays a role later. Again, this is some foreshadowing. Heavy duty still, though, right? Damn, that's wild. That's wild. You're a parent. You're just a memory for your kids. Pretty deep. Now, Murph, she reveals that there's been another binary ghost message because she's trying to persuade Coop, her dad, like, hey, don't leave. I got a message from the ghost again. It says stay. And he's still in his scientific frame of mind. He's like, this kid with her nonsensical imagination. He's like, no, I'm out. And he leaves. So then we have this sort of brief discussion on the theories of time dilation, which held true to Einstein's theories of relativity, meaning like as one travels or approaches the speed of light or travels to the black hole, time slows down. So when Cooper, he's out there flying around black holes and stuff, his time will slow down. But meanwhile on Earth, the time will not. Meaning when he gets back home in 2 years for Cooper, it might be 20 years for Murph. Which is one of the big interesting points of this film is that they held it so true to the theories of physics. So that concludes Act 1. Act 1 called F Them Kids, I'm Out. So Act 2 starts. Hey, you know what? I didn't do it. I didn't make the film that way, but that's what they did. Cooper's out, leaving his kids with no parents, crying on the bed. Act 2 starts. NASA and Cooper, they're all going out to space, and they're like, okay, it's going to take 2 years to get to Saturn. And this is where you get a lot of the cool little Kubrick 2001 space-type shots. They talk about the unknown. How they put a spherical wormhole out by Saturn. Because when you take a two-dimensional hole in three dimensions, you get a sphere, right? Again, this is a little foreshadowing, a little conceptual molding of what this story is about. It's about man accessing the higher levels of dimension. Abstracting. And this is a great part to watch. Good film. Good film. Now, they temporarily go into this extra dimension above 3D, I think. I don't know. When they go into the wormhole. Then they get on the other side. They find out that one of the planets, Miller, is very close to this massive black hole called Gargantua. And the high gravity of Gargantua means that relativity will shift their time experience like we already talked about. So like for every little bit of time they spend out near this black hole, a lot of time on Earth is going to fly by. And you find out during this little interchange that Plan A, saving the people on Earth, wasn't ever really feasible because of relativity. Because 1 hour on this Miller planet is 7 years on Earth. 1 hour on Miller is 7 years on Earth. And they shame Cooper for only thinking about his family. And we confirm, see, nerds don't have empathy. They only like science.
Transmitter failure?
Maybe. He was sending the thumbs up right until it went dark.
But Miller still looks good, though, right? Because she's coming up fast.
Mm-hmm.
With one complication. The planet is much closer to Gargantua than we thought.
Gargantua.
It's what we're calling them, the black hole. Miller's and Dr. Mann's planets both orbit it.
And Miller's is on the horizon?
Oh, it's a basketball around a hoop. Landing there takes us dangerously close, and a black hole that big has a huge gravitational pull.
Look, I could swing around that neutron star to decelerate.
No, it's not that. It's time. The gravity on that planet will slow our clock compared to Earth's drastically.
Well, how bad?
Well, every hour we spend on that planet will be 7 years back on Earth. That's relativity, folks.
Well, we can't just drop down there without...
Cooper,
we have a mission. Yeah, Doa, we have a mission, and our mission, Plan A, is to find a planet that can habitate the people that are living on the Earth right now.
You can't just think about your family. Now you have to think bigger than that, all right?
I am thinking about my family and millions of other families, okay? Plan A does not work if the people on Earth are dead by the time we pull it off.
No, it doesn't. That's why there's a Plan B.
Okay, Cooper's right. We need to think about time as a resource, just like oxygen and food. Going down there's gonna cost us.
All right, look. Dr. Mann's data is promising, right? But it's going to take us months to get there. And Edmund's, it's even further. Now, Miller hasn't sent much, but what she has sent is very promising. It's water, it's organics.
You don't buy that every day.
No, you don't. And just think about the resources, including time that would be spent trying to get back here.
So they make a compromise. They're like, okay, let's just go do a real short trip on Miller to minimize the amount of time on Earth that flies by. And they're taking a look at Gargantua, which looks like a massive Saturn. And more importantly, they actually refer to it as the Heart of Darkness. Okay? Gargantua is the heart. And again, images on the Instagram. So the Heart of Darkness. Well, we got to get a little deep into the occult philosophies as to why this is important. Because there's this idea of the dark path through the center of the Kabbalistic Tree of Life, which takes you into Daoth, which is the hidden realm. And this is the abyss. This is the abyss that Aleister Crowley talked about approaching when one was ready, prepared, to be dissolved into the black nothing. And this is the realm in which, if the initiate is not prepared to enter, they will lose themselves entirely. And they approach this thing called Coron Zone. It's a wacky old thing, but anyway. This Daoth, the hidden realm on the Tree of Life, is akin to the Heart of Darkness. Which is, again, where you get Darth Vader, Daoth Vader, who demonstrates the outer hidden realm of Daoth, as well as the symbolism of Saturn with his black outfit, the black cube. And that's why they're all called Darth, like Darth Maul, Darth Sidious, Darth Vader. They're all referenced to Daoth. Because these ancient occultists, the ancient wisdom, believes that Saturn is the outermost planet. It's the adversary planet. It's the necessary evil. It's the other side, the antinomian, the shadow side. It's all these things. It's the materialization of spirituality that created the world in which we live. And then what they want to do is reverse that. They want them to spiritualize the entire material world. Again, fitting into the stories and the sequels of the Space Odyssey novels, which we'll get into soon enough. So they're like, okay, let's do this. So they get on Miller. They touch down. It's a water planet. Damn it. And they find out that the beacon is actually underwater and that massive waves are coming to kill them. So they're like, well, damn, Miller's dead, clearly. And, you know, they basically get out of there. They lose one of the NASA nerds. He's dead now. But Cooper and Brand, who is NASA's, she's played by Anne Hathaway, Brand. Okay, that's her name. She actually plays a big role in this film. She's Cooper's consort in the tale. But they get off of the Miller. Took way longer than they wanted to. They get back up into like the mothership. And one of the NASA nerds that got left behind, he's like, yo, where you been? It's been like a million years. It's been 23 years. But they get into a little fight.
What happened to Miller?
Judging by the
Wreckage. She was broken up by a wave soon after impact.
So how's the wreckage stay together after all these years, huh?
Because of the time slippage. On this planet's time, she just landed hours ago. She probably just died minutes ago.
The data Doyle received was just the initial status, echoing endlessly.
Oh, you're not prepared for this. Yeah, guys. You have the survival skills of a Boy Scout troop.
Well, we got this far in our brains, farther than any human in history.
Well, not far enough. And now we're stuck here, till there won't be anyone left on Earth to save.
I'm counting every minute, same as you, Cooper.
Is there any possibility? I don't know, some clever way we could maybe, I don't know, jump in a black hole, gain back the years. Don't shake your head at me.
Time is relative, okay? It can stretch and it can squeeze, but it can't run backwards. It just can't. Right? The only thing that can move across dimensions like time is gravity.
And you hear Cooper, he takes a jab at the nerds, because the reason that it took him so long was because Brand and Hathaway, she tried to reach for the brass ring and get the data off of this recorder, because scientific observation, right? And the whole time, Cooper's like, look, we gotta go. There's this massive wave coming. We're all about to die. And she's like, no, I need the data. I'm a scientist. So her mistake cost them decades on Earth. Cooper's sad, and he calls them eggheads. I love it. He's picking on the nerds now. Now he's starting to wake up to the idea that, well, maybe science isn't the end-all be-all. We then hear a little bit about these fifth-dimension creatures.
The beings that led us here, they communicate through gravity, right?
Yes.
Could they be talking to us from the future?
Maybe.
Okay, if they can.
They are beings of five dimensions. Right, to them, time might be another physical dimension. To them, the past might be a canyon that they can climb into, and the future, a mountain they can climb up, but to us, it's not, okay? Cooper, I screwed up. I'm sorry. But you knew about relativity.
My daughter was 10 years old. Couldn't teach her Einstein's theories before I left.
Couldn't you have told her you were going to save the world?
No. When you become a parent, one thing comes really clear. And that's that you want to make sure your children feel safe.
And again, we'll get into that a little bit later. But anyway, they get off the planet, they get up to the orbiter thing. The little screw-up means that the orbiter's been up there for 23 years, and 23 is important in Discordianism. It's a fake religion, kind of, in Robert Anton Wilson's Illuminatus trilogy, which 23 is 2 plus 3, the law of fives. All things happen in fives, divisible by five. I just found that curious, right? And then, Cooper's like, okay, so they get up there. Cooper's like, well, damn, it's been 23 years on Earth. I missed everything. So he hears the, he's like, I'm going to listen to my 23 years of messages that he missed while he was splashing around in the bathtub on the planet Miller. Meanwhile, on Earth, the kids had already given up on dear old dad. They're pissed at him for leaving. Ain't that a bitch? Murph's all grown up. She's working on science. She's now trying to unlock the secrets for gravity for Plan A. It's been 23 years and they're still trying to figure it out. Meanwhile, back in space, they only have enough fuel to hit one more planet because they screwed up. Remember, there was three planets they were going to check out. One of them was Miller. X that off the list. They only got enough fuel to hit one more. So they get into a little debate about where to go. Brand and Hathaway, she's like, I say we go to Edmund's planet. But then Cooper calls her ass out and he's like, yeah, here's the problem with this. Brand is in love with Edmund's, the guy on the planet. So that is very unscientific. Then there's like a good little conversation about how love is an element that transcends time and space. It is actually the higher dimension.
granted, but Edmund's data is more promising.
We should vote.
Well, if we're going to vote, there's something you should know. Rand, he has a right to know.
That has nothing to do with it.
What does?
She's in love with Wolf Edmonds.
Is that true?
Yes. And that makes me want to follow my heart. But maybe we've spent too long trying to figure all this out with theory.
You're a scientist, Bran.
So listen to me. When I say that love isn't something we invented, it's observable, powerful. It has to mean something.
Love has meaning, yes. Social utility, social bonding, child rearing.
We love people who have died. Where's the social utility in that?
None.
Maybe it means something more, something we can't yet understand. Maybe it's some evidence, some artifact of a higher dimension that we can't consciously perceive. I'm drawn across the universe to someone I haven't seen in a decade, who I know is probably dead. Love is the one thing we're capable of perceiving that transcends dimensions of time and space. Maybe we should trust that, even if we can't understand it yet. All right, Cooper. Yes. The tiniest possibility of seeing Wolf again excites me. That doesn't mean I'm wrong.
Honestly, Amelia, it might.
Tars, chart a course for Dr. Mand.
But yes, after all that love talk, Cooper's like, Tars, flight a course to planet Man. Ha! Gotcha, bitch. Science nerds win. F your love. F Edmonds. F you, Anne Hathaway. Oh, man. It was great. Good part of the movie there. Now, meanwhile, back on Earth, Murph. She finds out that Plan A, this whole time, she's been working on the formula for 23 years. She's talking to old boy who's been working on it before her, and turns out it's all bullcrap. It's not going to happen. There's no formula for overcoming gravity. What is you, stupid? There is no plan A. It's fake news. Plan B was the only plan all along. These 5,000 embryos. Just like Raised by Wolves, right? It's the same thing from Raised by Wolves. The hacker nerd, like, you know what? We need to start brand new. So they're back in space. And they land on Man. Planet Man. And it's a frozen planet. Oh, geez, here we go, right? Went from nothing but water to nothing but ice. They march out to the camp where Dr. Mann has been living for all these years. And they wake him up because he's sleeping in one of his little pods. And guess who it is? Guess who plays Dr. Mann? Matt Damon. Yes, Matt Damon. He wake him up. They wake his ass up. And this was actually a big secret on the film. No one knew this was coming. I think I saw this on opening weekend, if I'm not mistaken, and I was surprised too. Because they didn't put his name on the credits. He wasn't in the trailer. They didn't even let him attend the premieres. Good little surprise for everybody. I like a good surprise. So Dr. Mann, he was basically committing suicide. He went to sleep in the pod. He didn't even set a wake-up date. And, you know, they make note of Lazarus and raising from the dead connection, right? Because they just rose Dr. Matt Damon from the dead, basically. And then we find out a little more about Plan A. And Plan A required this reconciliation of gravity with relativity. But to do that, you need to get information from the singularity inside of a black hole. But they can't do that. The gravity is so strong that the singularity is, and I quote, as they say in the film, hidden in darkness behind the horizon. Now, we're going to take a long detour here. It's going to be worth it, though. This is another reference to the abyss, the forbidden realm, the hidden zone, the mauve zone. This is, again, a Freemasonic principle of bringing the initiate from darkness to the light. They say the information they need to save mankind is hidden in darkness behind the horizon. Because in Freemasonry, they remove the mask from the initiate in the rituals to bring the candidate from darkness to the light. Previously, they were hidden in darkness. They were ignorant. They need the wisdom, the light, and the light is the lost word of Freemasonry. Now, Freemasons, they learn in the initiations that the secrets have all, the wisdom has all been lost. Let's refer to Albert Mackey's Encyclopedia of Freemasonry. There is a passage for lost word, and it says, and I quote, "The mythical history of Freemasonry informs us that there was once existed a word of surpassing value and claiming a profound veneration, that this word was known to but few, and it was at length lost, and that a temporary substitute for it was adopted. But as the very philosophy of Masonry teaches us that there can be no death without a resurrection," did you hear that? The philosophy of Masonry teaches us there can be no death without a resurrection. That is the principle you see on this film with Lazarus by its very definition. Let's keep reading, though. We're not done. There's no decay without a subsequent restoration. On the same principle, it follows that the loss of the word must suppose its eventual recovery. And then he describes it. Listen to this. As they describe looking for the lost word, the truth, the wisdom. Later on, he says, it's a mythical symbol of the decay and loss of the true religion among the ancient nations. The true religion among the ancient nations. They're telling you right there, there is an old solar religion, Luciferian faith, and that's the true religion. Let's keep reading, though. Okay, the true religion among the ancient nations at and after the dispersion on the plains of Shinar and of the attempts of the wise men, the philosophers and priests to find and retain it in their secret mysteries and initiations, which have hence been designated as the spurious Freemasonry of antiquity. Mackey, he then goes on to describe the search for the lost word as the metaphor for the initiate's journey upward through the degrees. My God. Isn't that what Matthew McConaughey is doing in the movie? Trying to achieve that 33rd degree? Yes, he is. Now, you go to your boy Bill Cooper, not the McConaughey Cooper, the Bill Cooper, and in his Mystery Babylon series, he asserts that the mystery schools, this is the repository of this ancient knowledge and the true religion that Mackey is alluding to. They believe that Horus was the newborn sun, and it means, the definition is word. So when we say the word was lost, Horus was lost. This is, the word is the monolith in 2001. Horus is the body of perfected adepts who are meant to defeat Christ in the unholy trinity of Osiris, Isis, and Horus. They're the sun. So when in the film, they say the secret teaching they need to save man is hidden in darkness behind the horizon, we have to consider the claim that horizon is Horus' sun. Okay? Horus' sun, horizon. Got that? Horus' sun, and God's son is, Horus, is killed by the prince of darkness at sunset. So Set kills Horus. The horizon is killed by the prince of darkness at sunset. The darkness kills the light. Again, you have to understand the Gnostic inversion ideas. The Christian God is the real oppressor. He's the real darkness, obscuring the true teachings of the old true religion that Mackey's talking about as the lost word. And according to Bill Cooper, which I do believe, I do subscribe to, the idea that this lost word talk is referencing a Luciferian religion that's been lost over time and obscured. back to the movie. There's a nice little conversation about how they can't even tell the masses about Plan A because they'll be scared. They can't tell them. And then Murph, she says that she's got another idea of how this could end based on a feeling. Okay. So she's going with her gut a little bit. So again, it's this idea that we have this hardcore science and then a little bit of, well, maybe I'll get in tune with my right brain thinking here. Back out in space, Matt Damon, Dr. Mann, he faked the data so that people would come and save him. He lied and said, hey, guys, come on down here, because he wanted to be saved. But the plan originally, they were supposed to be these brave astronauts, and the plan was you go to your planet, and if you die, if it's not habitable, guess what? You're dead. Sorry. That's why you're considered a brave astronaut. But Matt Damon changes his mind the last second. So anyway, he gets into a fight with Cooper, tries to kill him. Dr. Mann is officially the Judas-type disciple. He is the selfish deceiver. And, you know, drama ensues. Now, just to check in, we're only 2 hours into this movie. Still got 1 hour to go. Why do they do this? Why not just make it a part one and a part two? You can take double of my monies. I mean, but this particular film actually handles this very well. You don't even notice it. It actually is very, they do it about as good as you could ask for. So Matt Damon, he fights Cooper, but he basically blows himself up like Jack Parsons, dumbass. So he's already out of the picture. Boom, he's done. Cooper saves the day. They get back on the orbiter. They're like, okay, we got one planet left to check out. Edmund. That's our last hope. Here's the problem. We don't have any fuel left. Because you remember, Brand was out there like, oh, I need to get the data off the recorder. They've been burning all the fuel the whole time. So they decide, you know, Cooper, he's a smart guy. He's like, you know what we're going to do? We're going to fly around that massive black hole, Gargantua, as a slingshot. And that'll give us enough acceleration towards planet Edmund. This is a necessary evil. This is a move that's going to cost them another 51 years. And in the process, they also need to sacrifice Tars, one of the monoliths, into the black hole. Because it's Newton's third law. Okay? Every action has an equal and opposing reaction. So they need to jettison mass. That's your force, your mass times acceleration, in order to gain it. So if Tars, he's a robot, he don't care. He's like, yeah, send me in the black hole. And he says, I'll tell you what, if I see any information in that black hole, I'll shoot it out to you. And they're like, okay, perfect. Again, another incredible visual scene on the film. And they're going around the slingshot. They drop Tars. Like, see you later. And then, surprise, Cooper's like, okay, guess what? I'm out too. This guy loves surprising people with his bailing out. The guy doesn't know how to say goodbye. That's his problem. That's what this movie's all about. Matthew McConaughey doesn't know how to say goodbye. He just makes these abrupt departures. He looks over at Brad. He's like, guess what? I got a jettison too. But you need me to do that because you're not going to have enough acceleration to get to Edmund, so deuces. So he goes into the black hole too. Again, this is the Newton's third law. For every action, there's an equal opposing reaction. This is forces. And I took physics in college, took two semesters of it. Some of the most difficult courses I've ever taken, but incredibly rewarding. So much so, I kept my Fundamentals of Physics books by Halliday, Resnick, and Walker. 7th edition. You can do the math on that and figure out how old I am. Because, you know, every year they add a new edition to make you, you know, $300 book. Anyway. So this is what happens in 2001 Space Odyssey, by the way. Astronaut David Bowman, he goes towards the monolith out by Saturn. And it pulls him into a wormhole. And that's where he goes. And he's in the Hilton room where he becomes the star child. Then he saves Earth from itself by detonating the nuclear warheads. That's in the book version. Not the same in the film. But that's what Cooper's about to do. He's about to do the same thing. So he ejects from the crafts, goes into the black hole, which is, by the way, one of my worst nightmares. Terrifying. Again, another great part of the film. He falls into the singularity, and it's a coordinated grid. They call it the Tesseract. And he drags himself to a stop where he sees the bookshelf back home on Earth with Murph as a child. He's basically inside the timeline of history, of his memories. Because in this Tesseract, time and space are completely like effed in the A. It's all his memories, right? Laid out on a grid, sort of. And this is where he starts. He's like, oh man, this is a nightmare. And he's spelling stay in the Morse code to childhood Murph. He's the ghost, right? He's the ghost going back in time to tell Murph, hey, tell your dad to stay. I'm your dad, and I'm saying don't go. This is bad. And of course, this is exactly what Murph does. And Cooper doesn't believe her, and he leaves anyway, right? So he watches this memory of himself leaving after Murph tells him to stay, even though he's trying to speak to her through the Morse code, and she's reading it. He's the ghost. Just like he said, the parents are the ghost. Meanwhile, back on present-day Earth, adult Murph, she figures out, oh man, my dad was a ghost the whole time. Reaffirming that statement that he made before he left Earth about the parents and the kids and the ghosts. So she figures it out, right? Then we go back to the Tesseract. And Cooper, he gets radio comms from Tars. And Tars tells him, like, hey, they saved us. They, the aliens, or whatever they are, from the fifth dimension, they saved us.
Roger that.
He survived.
Somewhere in their fifth dimension, they saved us.
Who the hell is they? And just why do they want to help us, huh?
I don't know, but they constructed this three-dimensional space inside their five-dimensional reality to allow you to understand it.
Well, that ain't working.
Yes, it is.
You see, they created this three-dimensional Tesseract inside of their five-dimensional existence to help humans understand that time is a physical dimension and you can exert the force of gravity across space-time to send messages. Got that? Gravity can cross dimensions like time. Thus, TARS can send the quantum data back to Earth to Murph. We'll revisit that in a minute. Now, Cooper, he gets the binary coordinates for NASA's secret bunker, reveals it in the dust on the floor, the 33 stuff, right? He basically is like, hey, here's the coordinates. Go to the NASA secret lair because they're, you know, back to however many years ago. I lost track of time when Murph was a child and Cooper was still at home with her before he pulled a deadbeat dad on her. So he's revealing the coordinates in the dust to try to guide young Murph and Cooper to the NASA facility. And he went back in time to warn himself not to go to space and also reveal himself so that Murph could understand, right? That's what this was, is for Murph to understand that he was able to use gravity to send messages across space and time to the future or past. He is the bridge to connect mankind's three-dimensional world and send the messages so they can save themselves by accessing the five-dimensional world. It's all crazy. It's craziness, right? Who can follow this madness? But basically, he's trying to prove to her through the scientific method here, like, look, I'm from the future and the past. You can pick where you want to live on the timeline. Because you got the four dimensions. You got length, height, width. You got your position, right? Then you got, that's your three dimensions. Then you got your fourth dimension, which is time. The fifth dimension is a level of abstraction above that. Meaning, you can pick where on the timeline you want to view and interact with. Travel in the future or the past. Crazy stuff. Now, he makes note of how the Tesseract is all basically just Murph's room, right? He notices that. He's like, why is everything just Murph's room? When you're living in the fifth dimension, you can access any point of space and time. any point you want of the four dimensions of space and time. The aliens, they need a specific location in space and time to send these messages to. They don't know the right timing of when to send the Earth humans the information about this. But Cooper knows. He knows how to share that information because he's connected through a higher plane of consciousness of love to Murph. It's a pretty wild idea, right?
It's not a ghost. It's gravity.
Don't you get it yet, Tars? I brought myself here. We're here to communicate with a three-dimensional world. We're the bridge. I thought they chose me. They didn't choose me, they chose her.
For what, Cooper?
To save the world. All of this. One little girl's bedroom, every moment. It's infinitely complex. They have access to infinite time and space, but they're not bound by anything. They can't find a specific place in time. They can't communicate. That's why I'm here. I'm gonna find a way to tell Murph, just like I found this moment.
How?
Love, Tars, love. It's just like Brand said. My connection with Murph, it is quantifiable. It's the key.
What are we here to do?
Now this is basically the plot of the Space Odyssey sequels. Man evolves into the next dimension to live immortally. Now, he puts a message into the watch that he gave her as a child in Morse code, knowing that she would look at it as an adult. Because again, remember, love connects them. It transcends beyond the dimensions. So the adult Murph, she understands the Morse code. She's like, oh, Dad's in another dimension that we could also access and get off this loser planet Earth. She scribbles a bunch of equations at NASA, does a little homage to Archimedes by yelling Eureka, which in Greek means I have it. The message was a success. Tars says, the bulk beings are closing the Tesseract. And the Tesseract collapses. And Cooper reveals, he comes to the conclusion, the bulk beings, they're not aliens, it's us. It's us from the future of the future. These are further evolved humans that understand what five-dimensional living is. Mankind only knows the four dimensions, remember? So he understands, like, oh, it's a further enlightened form of mankind. It's not aliens, it's us. The Tesseract collapses. Cooper becomes some kind of light being. You see him going through the timeline, the four-dimensional timeline of space and time. He shakes hands with Brand, which was back at the beginning of the journey through space. When they travel through the wormhole, things get blurry at the beginning of the film, and she's like, oh, I shook hands. This is the first interdimensional contact. That was Cooper. Again, this is just like if you read 2010, Space Odyssey, Bowman, the guy who went to the hotel in 2001 and becomes the Star Child, he interacts with the humans in 2010. A messenger, an emissary. He appears on the TV in the book. He's combing his mother's hair. He's interacting with mankind, much like Cooper does. Cooper is the enlightened moon child. And when the Tesseract collapses and he turns into this being of light, you see him float past Saturn again. Just like the end of 2001, A Space Odyssey. What a movie. Now we're in the denouement. We made it. We made it. Cooper wakes up. And they tell him he's at Cooper Station, which is currently orbiting Saturn, by the way. And they named it after his daughter, not him. Because his daughter, remember, she got the formulas to unlock the fifth dimension. So they decide, so they're like, okay, Cooper, your daughter's really old now. She's dying. She's in the hospital bed. You can go visit her. And he goes and visits her, and now he's younger than her, right? and she's dying. She's on the deathbed. And she's like talking to him about how Brand is still out there on planet Edmund, a planet of death, how she's probably dying alone right now. So what does Cooper do? He leaves her again. He leaves his dying daughter again. He leaves her. He's like, you know what? I see you're dying, and I see I've already abandoned you one time. I'm about to do this again. Deuces. And he's like, I'm going to go save Brand. Hey, you know what? Maybe they're just setting up for the sequel, and that's fine. It was a great movie. Go for it. But yeah, he leaves her ass in the hospital bed. And you hear, and he's traveling out to save Brand on planet Edmund. Because man will explore, right? That's the idea here. But at the end of the film, you hear Murph, she's narrating. And she talks about how they're living by the light of the new sun. And she's talking about how Brand might be lying down to die by the light of the new sun in their new home.
She's... setting up camp.
Again, to put a capstone on this, no pun intended, no Illuminati pun intended there, 2001 A Space Odyssey in 2010, when you read those books, in 2010, you know what they do? The Monoliths create a new star for mankind, a new sun. And guess what it's called? I'll give you three guesses, you only need one. They call it Lucifer. Because in the book, the Monoliths, they become these self-replicating nanobots, and they increase their density of Jupiter until it becomes so dense it turns into a star and explodes, and now it's the new sun. It's Jupiter. So that's basically what Murph is saying at the end of Interstellar. She's saying that they're living by the light of the new sun out by Saturn. We also have hints of this breakaway civilization idea talked about on Raised by Wolves, especially because at the end you see Edmund's grave is a pile of stones. And if you recall from the Raised by Wolves show you've heard me do, the cult of Mithras, Mithras was a god who was born from a stone when lightning hit it. Lightning, again, a symbolic of Lucifer. So let's wrap it up. What was this movie about? Well, in conclusion, two main points. First point. Strangely enough, science is not the end-all be-all, right? That's what we find out when Cooper's experience and Murph's experience and love and all this stuff. Sometimes science isn't the guiding answer. An example of this, losing weight, right? You would think it's calories in, calories out, but it's not. Not entirely. The body's a holistic machine. You need all these other factors. You need your sleep. You need your certain composition of nutrients. You got to give the body what it needs. Doesn't mean science is wrong. It just means that whoever interprets the data can manipulate it and deceive. I've argued with engineers about this because they say, no, it's calories in, calories out. And there was like that, remember that jackass professor who ate a low-calorie diet of Twinkies for a month and lost weight? I mean, calories are part of the formula, right? For sure. It's a huge part of the formula, but it's not the whole thing. That's all I'm saying. Science is on some levels subjective, some levels. Just depends on what we're talking about. Now, second, the main theme of this tale is that it is the occult rebirth. Man must evolve into the next phase, the higher dimensions. Man must leave Earth. It's sort of Gnostic if you want to take it to that route. Nass is the hero in this story, but so is love and relationships. NASA saves mankind through the Lazarus missions. It's the alchemical rebirth of the dying man, which again, you go back to that conference room at the beginning of the film and you saw Lazarus with the all-seeing eye with the eagle, which is the phoenix. The alchemical rebirth of man because man is dying. Man is dead. Science and Love rebirths the star child of Matthew McConaughey.
All right, all right, all right.
The path to salvation was to go to Saturn, the adversary planet, the sixth one out there, right? That's why 666. It's the sixth planet out there. That's where they need to go to find the salvation. And Cooper goes through the black hole to find the lost word of Freemasonry, the secrets of the fifth dimension, and love, which transcends the dimensions. The fifth dimension is to collapse a wave of potential because there's infinite timelines and possibilities. So as we said at the beginning of this, the story is about the fusion of science and spirituality, which is in fact the transhuman. All right, I hope you enjoyed that show. That was a lot to get into. This will be a part of my my Use Your Illusion 2 book that I am working on. When will it be available? Mid to late 2021, probably. Just depends. If you haven't checked out Use Your Illusion 1, it's now up on Amazon. Audible, I mean, I narrated the audiobook, so I try to make it real easy for you. It's called Aliens, UFOs, and the Occult, Use Your Illusion 1. And yeah, you can check that out, because Use Your Illusion 2 is going to just go through many films to talk about how they've been conditioning the masses to accept the new reality. They've been giving us symbolism and messages of the occult through films such as Interstellar. And I'm here to reveal that truth to you, so you understand what is happening in this wacky world of ours. So check out those images again on Instagram that I put up for Interstellar. You could check me out on Twitter at Illuminati Eyes. Also, subscribe to the podcast, leave your reviews. So you could get me on the Patreon. You can get me on the Rockfin. Whatever you want. It's all yours. And until next time, stay woke.